Okay, so it sounds very enticing. Okay, well, I guess as a last question, you've got a goal this year of obviously establishing yourself. Let's say this year is really successful. What would your goal be for next year?
For this market? Our goal would be to assess what we did right and what we did wrong. How can we make it a better market for the vendors and the farmers? How can we make it a better experience for customers, but still be true to our initial philosophy, which is to have a market that's focused on local food?
Okay, and could you again give the URL so that people can go online to get more information about the Aberfoyle Farmers Market?
Absolutely. The website is afma.ca for the Aberfoyle Farmers Market.
And I've been talking with Peter McCluskey from the Aberfoyle Farmers Market. If you're interested in more information on what we've talked about today or previous shows or upcoming shows, please email me at waltergarrison@cfru.ca. All lowercase, all one, no spaces there. So waltergarrison@cfru.ca. This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, heard on CFRU 93.3 FM, broadcast out of Guelph, Ontario.
A major concern to the Aboriginal community, the way that whole issue was handled.
That nobody cares, the state doesn't care, and it's reflected in these laws, and it's reflected in the position they adopted in this court case.
The corporation knew that they did not have to negotiate.
Nesky will always be a part of the circle.
Welcome to Groundwire, Community Radio News.
This week's episode of Groundwire is produced on Sinek's traditional territory in the studios of CJLY, a cooperative community station in Nelson, British Columbia. In this edition, Bill Lightbone, a volunteer at Vancouver Co-op Radio, speaks about the release of the final report of the Davies Commission of Inquiry into the death of Frank Paul.
Groundwire's Carly Forbes reports on the appeal of the successful charter challenge instigated by three sex workers in Ontario by the federal and Ontario governments.
We also have an update on the search for Nesky Manuel. Nesky's body was found on June 29th on the shores of the South Thompson River downstream from Nisqually Reserve in Suwamish Territory in Interior British Columbia. You just heard from Keoki Takahashi and the band Radio with the song Ghost ESP Revelations. It's available on the anthology Matsuri, a collection of works by Japanese-Canadian musicians and composers.
Here are this week's headlines. Shelley Sillars, president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, Local 546 in Guelph, speaks about the federal government's back-to-work bill recently introduced by Federal Labour Minister Lisa Raitt. Entitled The Restoring Mail Delivery for Canadians Act, the union says that the bill denies 48,000 Canadian postal workers the right to free collective bargaining and that the action is unnecessary, unjust, and counterproductive.
The precedent that's just been set through this back-to-work legislation is actually a very scary one. This isn't just about Canadian Union of Postal Workers. This is about all workers. I think the Harper government is trying to send a clear message to unions and to workers everywhere that, you know, you either accept the lowball offer that the corporation will put on the table the first time, or, you know, the government will intervene and they will legislate a collective agreement. The Harper government is taking away the right to collective bargaining, which is a right that all Canadians have and all unions have. But unfortunately for the postal workers, I do believe that we were the example. We were pretty much the first. CAW, under the threat of back-to-work legislation with the Air Canada workers, accepted a really inferior offer, I believe, because they were afraid of what would happen with the legislation. And what just happened to the postal workers proves that they had a right to be afraid.
Thanks to Carly Forbes from CFRU for files for this story.
Asbestos is a fire-retardant construction material. Once popular, it is now banned in 52 countries worldwide and effectively banned in Canada through tight restrictions. This is due to the severe health problems associated with asbestos, with the World Health Organization claiming that at least 90,000 die every year from asbestos-related lung cancer, mesothelioma, and asbestosis resulting from occupational exposures. For this reason, the government has poured tens of millions of dollars into removing asbestos from public buildings like schools and the parliament. 24 Sussex Drive in Ottawa, Stephen Harper's residence, is also being stripped of the harmful substance. Despite this, and contrary to the advice and urgings of Health Canada and hundreds of other organizations worldwide, Canada blocked an attempt by the UN to list asbestos as a hazardous chemical at the Rotterdam Convention meetings in Geneva in late June. The convention needed a consensus for the listing to go ahead. Adding asbestos to the list would have required those importing the substance be informed of the risks as well as agree to follow costly safety protocols in handling the asbestos, which wouldn't have been good news for the Canadian asbestos industry. Although our country recognizes the devastating outcomes of asbestos at home, we continue to export $90 million worth each year from two mines in Quebec, almost all of which is exported to developing countries. New Democrat MP Pat Martin spoke out against the government's decision in Geneva, saying, quote, "Asbestos is the greatest industrial killer the world has ever known. More people die from asbestos than all industrial causes combined, yet Canada continues to be one of the largest producers and exporters in the world. We are exporting human misery on a monumental scale. Our position is morally and ethically reprehensible," end quote. When challenged over this controversial blockage of adding asbestos to the UN's list of hazardous chemicals, Industry Minister Christian Paradis has maintained that asbestos can be used in safe and controlled ways. This is, of course, exactly what would be regulated by the listing, as it would require importers to follow guidelines to meet this standard. But this is as close to an explanation as the Conservative government is willing to give. I'm Sam Kerviak from CGSR in Edmonton, reporting for Groundwire.
July 1st was the 28th anniversary of Canada's Access to Information Act coming into force. The legislation requires almost 200 departments in the federal government to give any information they hold, with only a few exceptions, to anyone in Canada. According to the Supreme Court of Canada, the purpose of the act is to facilitate democracy. Dr. Mark Weiler worries that our democracy is still in crisis, in part because we don't use access to information.
If you filled a room with 1,200 adults, about 740 would have voted, but on average, only one would have used their access rights.
Dr. Weiler started using his access rights while doing doctoral research. For him, public education is part of the solution.
We're the first generation in Canadian history to have this right, so it's not easy to find someone who will teach us.
For those wanting to learn how to use their access to information rights, Dr. Weiler suggests starting with fairly uncontentious requests, like a department's procedural manual, or a list of what others have requested about a certain topic.
Manuals give clues as to how a department is supposed to work, while lists of previous ATIs received by the department give you a clue as to what can be ordered.
Some types of information can be harder to get than others, but Dr. Weiler says the government's attitude is not the main barrier.
If people think about the Access to Information Act, they seem to use the mentality of an adult. They have a strong sense of certainty that it won't work, or are devoid of any kind of depth of curiosity, like that they wouldn't use it. We might have better luck learning how to use it if we approached it with the mind of a child, with a deeply seated sense of wonder.
To awaken your sense of wonder, Dr. Weiler has created an educational video that includes an example of a real access to information request and also a computer-animated movie.
The cartoon is about a freedom of information mage on an epic quest into an unknown land, the government of Canada. And it's meant to be entertaining while giving a few tips here and there about using the Access to Information Act.
If you want to learn more about the Access to Information Act and watch the educational video, go to Dr. Weiler's website at www.opengovernmentrecords.net.
A group is currently walking from Vancouver to Ottawa in the 2011 Walk for Justice with the purpose of raising awareness and demanding justice, closure, equality, and accountability for Canada's missing and murdered women and their families. Gladys Raddick and Bernie Williams co-founded the walk in 2008, and since then they've walked from Kamloops to Winnipeg in 2010 and from Vancouver to Prince Rupert in 2009. This year, once they arrive in Ottawa, after walking across Canada from June until September, they will call on Prime Minister Stephen Harper to hold a National Missing and Murdered Women Symposium in Vancouver, significant for its connection to the Picton murders and to the Highway of Tears. They are looking for accountability as well as an acknowledgement of racism and the sexist and racist systems in our country that have led to such an extensive number of deaths. For more information about the walk, including the two routes being followed, please visit fnbc.info/walk4justice.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Was Dallas Arcand with Quentin Tutusis and Don Demaray from the album Modern Day Warrior. Our first feature in this edition of Groundwire is about the release of the final report of the Davies Commission of Inquiry into the death of Frank Paul. At 8:18 p.m. on December 5, 1998, Frank Joseph Paul, a 47-year-old Mi'kmaq First Nations man living in Vancouver, was arrested in the downtown East Side by two Vancouver police officers for being intoxicated in a public place. He was taken to a Vancouver jail facility. Several minutes later, he was removed from the lockup, placed in a police van, and left in an alleyway in East Vancouver. Mr. Paul's body was found at the same location at 2:41 a.m. the following morning. According to the autopsy report, death was attributed to hypothermia due to acute alcohol intoxication. The coroner decided against calling a coroner's inquest, choosing instead to conduct an inquiry without a jury under Section 20 of the Coroner's Act. In the year 2000, the Vancouver Police Department concluded disciplinary proceedings against two officers involved in the case. One officer was suspended for 2 days for discreditable conduct, and the other officer was suspended for 1 day for neglect of duty. On several occasions, the Criminal Justice Branch of the Ministry of Attorney General examined the circumstances surrounding Mr. Paul's death. In each review, the branch decided not to proceed with criminal charges against any of the police officers involved. On February 22, 2007, the Solicitor General announced a public inquiry into the Frank Paul case. On March 9, 2007, he announced that William H. Davies, Queen's Counsel, would act as Commissioner. Justice Davies eventually produced two reports on the Frank Paul case, the second of which was released just last week. Bill Lightbone, co-host of Late Nights with Savages on CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio, has been following the case closely, and he shared perspectives on the reports, the public inquiry, and the Vancouver Police Department with Co-op listeners recently. On the topic of Justice Davies and the public inquiry, Lightbone had this to say.
I myself had a great deal, or still have a great deal of faith in Justice Davies. He did an excellent job as far as I'm concerned, and he was very fair-minded in the whole process, and he was very inquiring in regards to what really went on there. And, you know, there was a lot of the truth of what goes on with our police department here in Vancouver that came out in that particular hearing. And it gave the citizens of Vancouver an opportunity to see where there could be and should be a whole lot of improvements made in regards to how the Vancouver Police Department operates in Vancouver.
The first Davies report looked into the facts surrounding Frank Paul's death and the responses of all relevant official bodies except for the Criminal Justice Branch. This was because the Criminal Justice Branch challenged the inquiry's authority to inquire into matters of prosecutorial discretion. The BC Court of Appeal eventually clarified that with some restrictions, Justice Davies' inquiry into the death of Frank Paul could proceed. The report suggested that, while Davies does not suggest that the Vancouver Police Department conducted themselves improperly in the investigation of the death of Frank Paul, he does recommend that the police no longer investigate their own conduct in cases like these. Davies' second recommendation was that more needs to be done to meet the needs of Vancouver's homeless or alcoholic citizens, suggesting that the Vancouver Police Department's drunk tank be replaced by a variety of medical treatment options and an increase in low-barrier housing designed for the specific needs of chronic alcoholics. While expressing confidence in Justice Davies, Bill Lightbone remarks on the way that the Vancouver police officers that could have been charged in the death of Frank Paul were
highly protected by the prosecutors. As a matter of fact, I might also add here that three of the prosecutors that were involved in this whole process refused to testify, and the government of British Columbia protected those people. And in fact, the commissioner Davies was forced to take the government to court, and the court ordered those prosecutors to appear.
Bill Lightbone also has this to say about the great concern in the Aboriginal community about how the Frank Paul case was handled by the VPD.
As a citizen of British Columbia and as an Aboriginal person, of course, people probably realize that Frank Paul was of Aboriginal ancestry. And in fact, it is of major concern to the Aboriginal community the way that whole issue was handled. And I have to admit that Justice Davies was just as perturbed or almost as perturbed as the Aboriginal community in the way the whole thing was handled. And there was a very real effort, at least an apparent effort, to try and cover up for the police officers that were involved. And in my estimation, it was a racist attitude that really created the problem here. And the fact that Frank Paul was just another drunken Indian and of no major concern to the police department and those other people that were responsible for dealing with him and with the issue itself.
This is Catherine Fisher reporting for Groundwire. Thanks to Bill Lightbone and Gennargi O'Sullivan for files on this story.
In September 2010, Justice Himmel ruled to decriminalize sex work. The following day, the federal and provincial governments both appealed this ruling. From June 13th to 17th, the appeal was heard in court in front of a 5-judge panel with 7 interveners. Fred Chatbot, a member of POWER, an Ottawa sex workers organization, discusses the appeal.
What happened is that 2 hours later, both governments, so the Ontario government and the federal government, appealed the decision, and so the appeal was to take place about 6 or 7 months later. It ended up happening in June. So June 13th to June 17th. And at that point, it opens the door to interveners to come in. So interveners are stakeholders who have something to add to the case or have a position on the ruling and would have to add their argument to the entire case that is already existent.
POWER teamed up with Maggie's of Toronto to intervene in this case on behalf of sex workers.
One statement that certainly was sticking out was Cynthia, our lawyer, told the court that not only is sex work not valued in society, sex workers are not valued. I mean, sex work is kind of a concept. Like, the actual people who are on the receiving end of those statements and those laws and in that position from the government are sex workers themselves, right? So to put it bluntly, she said, nobody cares, the state doesn't care, and it's reflected in these laws, and it's reflected in the position they adopted in this court case.
Sandra Calhoun Chu, a senior policy analyst from the Canadian HIV Legal AIDS Network, discusses their stance as interveners.
We found evidence that, outreach workers who distribute lube and condoms and other safer sex materials and literature were having a hard time accessing sex workers because they're being policed so heavily that they're not, in places that it's easy for outreach workers to get in touch with them. The communicating provision in the criminal code, which prevents people from communicating in public for the purpose of prostitution, there's a lot of evidence that was presented that was about how it prevents sex workers from screening clients.
Right.
And what we said was, like, that's a huge harm to sex workers, but it also prevents you from negotiating the terms of what you're willing to do and whether you're willing to practice safer sex. So there's evidence that condom use is less likely to be enforced if you're not able to talk about it beforehand. And another issue that was sort of tangential to that was the fact that a lot of sex workers testified, or there was evidence at the trial record, that healthcare staff and professionals are very discriminatory towards sex workers. They face a lot of stigma. And we said that the law contributes to that stigma and therefore making it harder for sex workers to access professional and non-discriminatory healthcare that addresses their particular needs.
Amy Levovich, one of the plaintiffs in the case, talks about why it's so important for sex workers to be at the forefront of the discussion around decriminalization.
The removal of the laws and what they've done in New South Wales, Australia, and New Zealand is rational and regulation that makes sense and that people come to a consensus about, right? Sex workers being at the forefront of that discussion, and is a step in the right direction as far as also the discussion around that this is a choice for a lot of people, and it starts the discussion and it breaks down sort of the barriers that people have in their mind about what sex work and sex workers are.
Now that the appeal hearing has concluded, it will be another 6 months or more before any decision is released. Fred from Power talks about what the wait means for sex workers.
If it's a smaller case, there are three judges. This time there are five. And I got different feelings of judges' positions on the matter. So I'm sure they'll have a lot of work to do in terms of writing a decision for this. So I'm not expecting it to come out before Christmas. Like, it's probably going to be between Christmas and in a year. But personally, I find it really upsetting that it takes so long and the laws are stayed in the meantime, because it's going to affect so many people's lives. And I mean, these laws contribute to so much violence experienced by sex workers, especially street-based sex workers, that for me it's on the offensive side that we're keeping these laws in the meantime, when there's so much evidence that shows that they contribute to the violence and the vulnerability to violence.
I'm Carly Forbes from CFRU in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire.
With us, when a person enters our house, he becomes our guest, and we must treat him hospitably as long as he shows no hostile intentions. At the same time, we expect him to return to us equal treatment for what he receives. Some of our chiefs said, these people wish to be partners with us in our country. We must therefore be the same as brothers to them and live as one family. We will share equally in everything, half and half, in land, water, and timber, etc. What is ours will be theirs, and what is theirs will be ours. We will help each other to be great and good.
That is the voice of Nesky Manuel, taken from a documentary on the 100th anniversary of the Laurier Memorial. Written in the form of a letter, the memorial was dictated by the chiefs of the Suwepmik, Nkamup, and Okanagan Nations to their secretary, James Tate, a young Scot who settled at Spence's Bridge along the Thompson River. This documentary was featured on Groundwire last year. Nesky Manuel went missing on Sunday, May 8th, from his family's camping ground near Nisqually Lake. His body was found June 25th by a local rancher on the shore of the South Thompson River near Pritchard. On June 29th, what would have been Nesky's 30th birthday, the Shuswap Nation Tribal Council sent out a press release about Nesky's death. Meske was known to many of us in community radio. He contributed a music show on CFBX, a campus station in Kamloops, from 2004 to 2005. In 2007, he produced a spoken word show with a focus on Aboriginal news and Swepmik language and culture. He started Swepmik Radio in his home territory. In 2008, Meske was hired as an Aboriginal programming coordinator at CKDU in Halifax. He was an active member of the NCRA Native Caucus. His work has been featured on Groundware, and he contributed an essay about Swepmik Radio to Islands of Resistance, a book about pirate radio in Canada. Meske was passionate about the Swepmik language and worked on translating the Linux operating system into Swepmisen for School District 73. He was also a member of the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty. He was an avid runner and cyclist who once rode across Canada on a single-speed bike. He served on the Niskanen Band Council. On the day Neski's death was announced by the Shuswap Nation Tribal Council, Gunarji O'Sullivan, co-host of the Vancouver Co-op radio program Late Nights with Savages, read from the press release. Here is a short excerpt.
Meske always welcomed people into the circle. It's important that we found him, said Shuswap man Randy Sam. Meske is part of who we are, a gift from Creator who touched many people. We'll always hold him up as someone special to us. We call the people from all nations to come forward to stand with the support of Neske's beloved family and his friends at this time, said Chief Krishtan. Neske was open to life and the lessons it brings. We will all learn from this experience, and we will find our way as spiritual people to be thankful for our time with Neske and to live our lives to the fullest, safe in the knowledge that Neske will always be a part of the circle.
Yo, this one here goes out to the struggle in the tradition of the old poets. Yo, the nation of poets, we haven't forgotten that. Yo, in the tradition of Aresi Sekarshe, God bless his soul, I want to say something to you. My friends around the mic. Until the lion learns to speak, the tales of hunting will be weak. My poetry hails within the streets. My poetry fails to be discreet. It travels across the earth and seas, from Eritrea to the West Indies. It knows no boundaries, no cheese. It's studied in parts of Greece. I'm sick as far as lyrics, not with as far as gimmicks. I spit barrage and limit. They talk and rip it. I'm hip, the hop is living. I skip the eye. Obvious women don't get what I'm presenting. No rims, my mind is spinning. I was born and raised in a place where the tone of flame would blaze, where the foreigners not embrace, where they warn you jock and pace, where the loners lower their gaze, where the corners slower to chase, where they twist and turn in the maze, with a pistol upon your face.
That was Kanan with Until the Lion Learns to Speak from his album, The Dusty Foot Philosopher.
And now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. The Salmo Radio Society, broadcasting as CFAD, is a very small community radio station in British Columbia's mountainous interior region. Located in Salmo, BC, a village with a population of about 1,000 people, CFAD has about 12 volunteers and currently broadcasts to its community at just 5 watts. Catherine Fisher, a volunteer at nearby Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC, brings us this short report about CFAD and its plans to expand its operation.
Kootenai Co-op Radio volunteer Brigitte Huss spoke recently with Gerald Hutchman, also known as Hutch, of the Salmo Radio Society, about Salmo Radio's plans to expand their signal and go from having a developmental license to having a fully licensed radio station in Salmo, BC.
We're applying for our permit license. Of course, that'll determine what happens, you know, whether we can continue forward. I'm really hoping that we can do a lot more towards promotion of the radio station. I'm hoping that when we get this new license, one of the things that's happening there is we're going to increase our signal significantly. So right now, we're broadcasting in a blistering 5 watts, and that only gets about 7 kilometers out. And in the mountains here, it's tough. But with our new license, we'll be increasing that 150 watts, and so we're hoping to reach about a 20-kilometer radius.
Running a radio station in such a small place has some unique challenges. It's very difficult to get volunteers. There's very little money in the community often for it. Brigitte asked Hutch why he feels there should be a community radio station in Salmo.